Good morning. There are some stories that kind of work as parallels of a broader story. One includes the nets. I think our gospel for this morning is one of those stories. We don't often read it in its entirety because it's the whole of chapter 9 of John. But it tells the story of expectation, of healing, of misunderstanding, and of condemnation that actually parallels a lot of the broader passion story that we get elsewhere. I'm going to read two segments of the story here with a little bridge in between of my own creation so you don't miss out on about 20 verses of stuff along the way. So don't worry if it's not on the screen or not in your Bible. This is John chapter 9, verses 1 through 12, and then 24 through 34. As he went along, he saw a man blind from birth. Jesus' disciples asked him, "Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind?" "Neither this man nor his parents sinned," said Jesus. "But this happened so that the works of God might be displayed in him. As long as it is day, we must do the works of him who sent me. Night is coming when no one can work. While I am in the world, I am the light of the world." After saying this, he spit on the ground, made some mud from the saliva, and put it on the man's eyes. "Go," he told him, "wash in the pool of Siloam." This word means sent. So the man went and washed and came home seeing. His neighbors and those who had formerly seen him begging asked, "Isn't this the same man who used to sit and beg?" Some claimed that he was. Others says, "No, he only looked like him." But he himself insisted, "I am the man." "How then were your eyes opened?" they asked. He replied, "The man they called Jesus made some mud, put it on my eyes. He told me to go to Siloam and wash. So I went and washed, and then I could see." "Where is this man?" they asked him. "I don't know," he said. The Pharisees caught wind of this, and they questioned this man and his parents about how this happened. They knew that Jesus was a sinner because he had healed on the Sabbath. A second time, they summoned the man who had been blind. "Give glory to God by telling the truth," they said. "We know that this man is a sinner." He replied, "Whether he is a sinner or not, I do not know. One thing I do know is I was blind and now that I can see." They asked him, "What did he do to you? How did he open your eyes?" He answered, "I have told you already and you did not listen. Why do you want to hear it again? Do you want to become his disciples too?" Then they hurled insults at him and said, "You are this fellow's disciple. We are disciples of Moses. We know that God spoke to Moses, but as to this fellow, we don't even know where he comes from." The man answered, "Now that is remarkable. You don't know where he comes from, yet he opened my eyes. We know that God does not listen to sinners. He listens to godly persons who do his will. No one has ever heard of opening the eyes of a man born blind. If this man was not from God, he could do nothing. To this they replied, "You were steeped in sin at birth. How dare you look for us?" And then they threw him out. More often than not, it is our expectations that shape our reality. Almost more than anything else, what we anticipate often determines what we then experience and how we perceive. I know that I too often have that sinking feeling where I have to actually stop and check, did I actually look both left and right before I went through that stop sign? So far, so good, but nevertheless, there it is. If you don't think anything's coming, maybe you don't always look. We have our expectations of the world. How the world, what's good, bad, or ugly, how things function, who is a hero, and what they look like, and who is the villain, and how they behave. And it can be hard when things don't turn out the way that we expect, or when we have our perceptions played with. What we look for often determines what we see. I have a video that I think it illustrates the point rather well.
This is an awareness test. How many passes does the team in white make?
Go!
The answer is 13. But did you see the moonwalking bear?
No!
So let's be honest here. And first of all, it is March Madness after all, so we're just like, hey, best of all, awesome. And how many were awfully proud that, yeah, I got 13? Absolutely. Then how many actually saw the moonwalking bear even the second time? It was there both times. Like the magical sleight of hand, we are always meant to look at what we're supposed to and not necessarily everything that's going on. And if I want to do something down here, what I need to do is make a big deal over here so you're not looking down here. And that can change how we see the world. I think it's precisely this shift in expectation and attention that lies at the center of our text for this morning. I will really say that this is not my favorite text. It's one that over the years I have frankly avoided. Not because it's not of value or fantastic. It is, and it speaks of the grace of God, and like I say, it's a bit of a parallel for the whole gospel. But over the years, for me, I've fielded the question literally of, okay, where is the sin? I've been asked, Bryce, what happened, and what did your parents do that you turned out the way that you did? Which is usually when I pick up some sort of smart remark and laugh it off. But that doesn't make it fun. But that's my problem, to be sure. But it does stand to mention that I find Jesus' response to that central question most pertinent and applicable to most circumstances. There's never any sin. Only the circumstances where God is at play here. I think that answer can stand in many ways, even if those circumstances are not immediately obvious. But we know that the question is relevant and is still with us. Because that's how we want our world to work. We want our world to make sense in a rational sort of way. You have condition A and you have conditions B, so you get result C. And that's just how it is. And it's a formula and you keep going. A tragedy, a problem, a peculiarity runs us against the grain, and we want to know what's going on. And often we struggle to simply regard what we witness as the reality of life, rather than to explain it or attribute its origin in one way or another. We expect causality, and that's what we get. We find it harder to see the challenge of knowing grace nestled within all things. It's a whole lot easier to explain things than to work to heal them. Whether the patient in question is the person on the street or the person looking at us in the mirror. We are always translating our world between the experience we know and how we actually live. The rule and the reality is are often separate things. We know what the rules of the road are. We know that if we go above the posted speed limit, we are liable to get a ticket. But also, if you've been driving for more than a couple of days, you know that there are some situations where going the legally posted speed limit is a great way to get run over. So it's often way wiser to go with the flow of traffic than the rule of law. So we go with the spirit rather than the law. We do this all over life and all the time. And it doesn't make us a hypocrite, it just makes us human. And what we say about God, it really is no different. Quite often we have two categories of our theology. The stuff we say about God and the way that we live within our experience of God. This is called formal and practical theology. Formal is exactly what it sounds like. The things that we say about God and God's characteristics and the creeds and the Sunday school answers that we all have. Jesus was of God and was crucified under Pontius Pilate, was buried and rose on the third day. That God's love is all-encompassing. That things will come for the living and the dead. All of the things that we say formally. But we don't often live in that formal reality. We're more given to the practical reality of how we live our faith today to day. And sometimes the formal translates into the practical, and sometimes it does not. Sometimes we know that God is all-loving, But on occasion, we have a God in our own head that is rather disappointed in me, because I know that I'm disappointed in myself. Or while we might believe that God remains capable of healing all our many ills, we also suspect that God may well be taking a break from the healing business. We can speak of the loving parenting God while feeling the tension of receiving a model of parenting that was anything but. There can be inconsistencies between what we proclaim and what we expect. And again, what we expect is what we find. That doesn't make us unfaithful or inconsistent. It simply reveals a disconnect that is often present in our lives between who we were created to be and how we live in them. Sometimes the most difficult step on the path of spiritual healing, especially in one of personal pain and trauma, is imagining a God of the universe that can fully love us, warts and all, when we struggle hard to love ourselves. Conversely, when we expect to find judgment, quite often that's precisely what we find, whether or not it is realistically there. That's exactly what's going on in this story. Everyone is expecting to find what they know to be true to play out. That's the root of the disciples' question. They know that the causality of suffering is sin. So they just want to know where it comes from. The Pharisees know that people must follow the rules. And they know that Jesus is not very good at following the rules. So that must mean that there must be something wrong here. They have their expectation and they get their vision accordingly. But Jesus' sight is not so filtered. When the man born blind is healed, it is the expectation of the community around him that complicates the matter. It's navigating these expectations that make it hard. The Pharisees have expected Jesus to be exactly who they expect him to be, a sinner, a radical, and someone not to be trusted. And his most recent infraction simply confirms what they know already. The Sabbath must be maintained, therefore healing on the Sabbath cannot be of God. It only cements the liability that they already have. They were not looking for grace, so they missed the glory of God that walked right on by. The whole community is in an uproar simply because the script has been changed and the one who's been on the outside is now healed and needed to show them the light of what was going on. But even that's hard, because it's far easier to maintain the expectations of how the world works than to reformulate the cause and effect that we have so long come to embrace. As hard as it was for the Pharisees to find their way into this healing, it is equally difficult for the one born formerly blind. He was healed. He was enjoying his first moments of sight, but no one is celebrating. Instead, they're still stuck in analysis. his parents step out from him and say, when they're asked, well, what is going on here with your son? They say, we don't know. He's of age. It's his problem. They couldn't see the way forward either, and not knowing what to make of the mystery of a healing, they decide to go with what's there. In the end, it's the boldness of the healed that tells the tale. After he's thrown out of the court of the Pharisees, he meets Jesus again, seeing him in person for the first time. Learning who he is and what it means to follow him, he falls down in worship, giving thanks to God's work in Jesus. Because at the end of all the analysis and judgments, he knew one thing. He was given a gift, and for that gift he was grateful. It is in that that he can celebrate, that he can break out of the expectations that everyone had for him in living God's way. There's an old tale of pastor's lore, of a longtime member coming to a pastor saying, Pastor, I need to lead the church. And of course the pastor was concerned and sat down and asked her, why? What's going on? Well, I used to come to church. I used to hear so often exactly who I am and how bad I am. I don't hear that enough anymore. I need to hear that to get through the weeds so I can behave. So I need to go find some place where I can find the reflection of who I know myself to be and not the grace that I now hear. Often we get from God what we expect to receive. We take in the light that we expect to get. When we know ourselves to be one thing, that's how we expect to be known and to exist and to be. And it can be really hard to change. Looking again at our cast in this little micro play of the gospel, I think I would love to play the one who was healed. There's such wonder, hope, and spirit going on there. And you kind of cheer when he stands up and says, oh boy, wouldn't you like to be his disciples too? Yeah, I suspect that I'm far better suited for the role of the doubter, the explainer, and the inspector who cannot see what they are presented with than for looking for something new. I don't come to that conclusion to say that I am bad, but that I simply all too painfully know my well-tethered expectations of knowing how things work. As much as I might like to say otherwise, I think this is where I guess we find ourselves, more often with the Pharisees than with the healed. We've been part of this messy thing called church for long enough that we suspect that we are shaped and formed as we are going to get. And maybe that we've been through the fire for too long and we now find ourselves brittle. You may well know our Sunday school answers, but our practical theology tends to be a bit more bound by the expectations of rule and the perception of the Spirit footing where it will. I guess that we probably spend more time wondering at what we see than rejoicing in seeing it. And that's probably why we are so uncomfortable with the response that we find here. Few of us number ourselves among the outsiders. Few of us number ourselves among the healed. And even if we would like to think that we could play the part in a pinch, it's never fun to realize that you're not the hero in the story. We see ourselves in the midst of the expectation, and that is never comfortable. But we do have good news, and that is that we do have a choice. Even as we acknowledge our expectation of a rational and reasoned world, we do not necessarily need to stay there. We have the ability and the invitation to take on the light of the world and to look for that light wherever it might shine. We have the ability and to reach out beyond what is usual and ask what God might be doing here and now. It can take many forms. It could take the form of simply naming our inclination of what we expect to happen. That God prospers those who are prosperous and punishes those who, at the time, struggle. We can recast the story of the nameless bystander from one of simply guilt and shame and choice, but also a system that does not do well at supporting people who hurt. We can move from the skeptic to the curious bystander who managed to say, "Wow, I don't know how you were given sight. I don't know how you were healed, but I am glad that you were. To God be the glory." Or perhaps we could be the lifelong friend who stood beside the person through good and bad, and who can finally rejoice with them in saying, "Yes, through all things, God has been good." There are many ways to walk the way of healing in our way. There's many ways to bear the light forward. And it's far more important to keep walking in faithful hope and the expectation of God's healing than to understand what is going on or to categorize the moments of particular fitting our model and our time. We get to choose how we incarnate the Christ who is healing, who is the light of the world, who is the light that we to bear. And that makes all the difference. May God's kingdom ever defy our expectations and call us to look beyond even that which we most expect to see. Amen.